When actress Zooey Deschanel was pregnant with her first child, she and her then-husband Jacob Pechnik took a closer look at what they were eating. Deschanel wanted to eat cleaner and healthier, but was shocked at the cost of fresh organic produce. "We wanted to figure out a way we could make growing at home easy, affordable, and accessible," she says. Pechnik went to work on the problem. A San Antonio native with a degree in chemical engineering who'd already launched a couple of software businesses, he started his own aquaponic farm in Austin, Texas. In the process, he learned the sticker shock issue with store-bought produce traced not to the growing, but to the transporting. 52% of perishable products never gets eaten, he says. It dies along the way, including in your fridge the day after you bought it. To eliminate the waste that comes from produce spending too much time in truck, Pechnik and Deschanel created a business to make at-home farming easy for everyone. Called Lettuce Grow, the product they created is a home grow system with a reorderable supply of baby plants that arrive in the mail and are clicked into place in teardrop-shaped vertical growing containers they call farm stands. Place them inside or outside, plug them into an outlet, and they save water. The BPA-free FDA food-grade plastic containers come in different sizes. There's a teeny farm stand for the beginner, which can grow a dozen plants, a large one that holds 36 plants, and three sizes in between, five in all. I didn't have any prior gardening experience and wasn't familiar with growing my own food, Deschanel says. Lettuce Grow makes it possible for people without a green thumb or any gardening experience at all to be successful growers. You can customize your growing plan based on what you like to eat and how often you cook at home. There's a lot more than lettuce. The company now offers more than 200 varieties of leafy greens, herbs, vegetables, and edible flowers, depending on season and growing region. The system's growing cycle is 30% faster than what it would be if you planted the same plants in the ground. And the growing season is longer, even through the coldest months of the year. With the newly added lighting kit, you can grow indoors year-round. We're trying to get the message out and the product out and get as many people as we can growing. We want to get into 1 million households in the next 4 to 5 years, Pechnik says. For every 10 that are purchased, we donate one to a school. It's important to us, democratizing the process of food. We want to help people who need it most. To find out more, go to lettucegrow.com. The best of the West. A decade of destinations. For the 10th edition of CNI's Best of the West issue, we offer a retrospective of some of the greatest featured places and experiences. It is our mission at CNI to share with readers our views of the American West of yesterday, today, and tomorrow. That becomes particularly important for each May-June issue, in which we gather editors' and readers' recommendations and favorites for the annual Best of the West section. We always aim for a careful balance between the tried and true and the exciting and new. So before this young decade leads us to new experiences and places, it's helpful to look back on where we've been and what left lasting impressions. 2011. On the cover, Graham Greene as Kicking Bird in Dances with Wolves covered the magazine to represent our spotlight on important big-screen native characters. Inside, we sought recommendations from readers and editors alike when putting together the inaugural Best of the West edition, Folks featured in the June issue of CNI that year included singer-songwriter Ryan Bingham, Native American Olympic athlete Billy Mills, and late Western writer Elmer Kelton, among others. We extolled the virtues of Carhartt jackets, Western-styled blue jeans, salsa, and working dude ranches. There was even a list of 11 must-see rodeos. The Utah-Arizona border, the View Hotel, Monument Valley. John Ford called it the most complete, beautiful, and peaceful place on earth. And when the great Western director needed a killer backdrop for Stagecoach and The Searchers, he plunked John Wayne down in that favorite place of his, Monument Valley, which is how the remote spot on the Utah-Arizona border became one of the most recognized vistas in the world, while remaining one of the least visited. There's a reason for that. The valley proper is huge, 30,000 acres, and remote, 300 miles from Phoenix. And there is nowhere to stay in Monument Valley itself. That changed in December 2008 when the first accommodations within Monument Valley Navajo Tribal Park opened. The brainchild of Navajo Armada Ortega Gordon, the View Hotel couldn't have been built by just anybody wanting to capitalize on development potential. It took someone who was sensitive to Native culture and the sacred nature of the place, and also to the need for economic opportunities for the local people. It was a family and tribal venture. Navajo-funded and Native American-built, the finished product would also be Navajo-owned and staffed. Ortega Gordon's vision called for the $14 million hotel to harmonize in form and color with the landscape, which it does, rising an unassuming three stories from a plateau in the same red sandstone color as its surroundings. When it came to naming the View Hotel, there couldn't have been many contenders that summed it up quite so succinctly. Facing those iconic stratified sandstone formations of Monument Valley, Valley of the Rocks, Subit Nisku in the Diné language, it's all about one thing, the view. In the same utilitarian way that the name of the place gets the job done, the accommodations take care of business. Everything is clean, rooms are comfortable, service is capable, food is good, decor is native, fireplace is massive. And all rooms have that incomparable view. That is what you're here for, after all, as the floor-to-ceiling windows would indicate. And what balcony? Well, that's your new best friend for the duration of your stay. Day and night, by sunlight, starlight, moonlight, you and your best balcony friend are going to be spending quality time together. The only time you might miss the main attraction is when the fog rolls in. 2012, Washington State. On the cover, an inside profile of the late photographer Carl Moon afforded us the opportunity to lead with one of his most famous portraits, Navajo Boy. Inside, we had a lot of fun with lists in this edition, ranking staples such as craft beers, pearl snap shirts, cowboy songs, and Western movie soundtracks. Other spotlights in our second Best of the West issue included Hopi jeweler Charles LaLoma, budding country trio Pistol Annies, National Park visionary John Muir, and the culinary tradition of Tex-Mex. Washington is like the corner office. Big, stunning views, a certain undeniable cachet. Starbucks aside, birthed in Seattle in 1971, the state named after George is the consummate outdoor playground. With its natural beauty and a resident population known for their outdoor pursuits, It's no wonder recreational equipment giant REI was founded here. Timberlands and beaches, rainforests and deserts, mountains and lowlands. No other state boasts such a diverse topography and climate. Where else can you find glaciers and volcanoes? Indeed, it's the extremes of the place that make it so appealing. Home to monoliths like Mount Rainier, Mount St. Helens, and Microsoft, and, of course, its founder, Washington native Bill Gates, Washington is a study in coexisting contrasts. Business climate? In Forbes top 10. Green consciousness? In Forbes top 5. More than half of the evergreen state is covered with forest. It's also rich in water, the Pacific Ocean, Puget Sound, and lots of rivers, including the famous Columbia. That water is some of the country's cleanest. And there's also wine, nearly 700 wineries in some 12 official viticultural areas. Such abundance drew dozens of native tribes to live here long before the European encounter. There were salmon, oysters, and clams in the waters, berries and nuts in the forests, and plentiful cedar for canoes and longhouse shelters. Descendants of those historical Pacific Northwest tribes live today on the more than 20 Indian reservations dotting the state. From apple orchards, salmon canneries and breweries to gold mines, lumber mills and railroads, Washington has contributed in no small part to the building of the West. Now, some 200 years after Lewis and Clark traversed it in 1805, the state boasts one of the world's greatest cities and some of the country's most pristine wilderness. The whole place considered, we agree with what former Governor Chris Gregor said about folks lucky enough to live there. We're blessed by birth. 2013. Pendleton, Oregon. Pendleton Woolen Mills. On the cover, the striking cover featured an ultra-cool Army Hammer, masked for his role in the year's big-budget adaptation of The Lone Ranger. Inside, we picked up a new theme for the third installment of The Best of the West, Western Essentials. Think things we'd never want to do without in life. The canoe, the cast-iron skillet, work gloves, jerky, ranch dogs, the teepee, and rope. Those items and more were treated to thoughtfully penned odes. In the mid-1600s, European fur traders found that English-made woolen blankets were valuable commodities that could be bartered for pelts with North Americans, who quickly realized the machine-loomed fabric provided a convenient alternative to traditional hide robes and natural fiber weavings. But despite the success of overseas manufacturers like Hudson's Bay Company, it took a while for an American-based wool industry to provide an alternative to the initial utilitarian designs. Enter Oregon-based Pendleton Woolen Mills. Founded in 1909, the company would become one of the most successful American brands to trade in Indian blankets, due in large part to the original company designer, who spent time with local tribes to learn their preferences for color and pattern, and then incorporated the traditional motifs into mass producible interpretations. Over the next century, the family-owned business expanded to clothing and home accessories, yet they never forgot their roots. Blankets remain at the heart of Pendleton, which continues to work with Native American artists on new designs. 2014. Missouri Ozarks, Big Cedar Lodge. On the cover, actor Liam Neeson was the main June 2014 cover star, thanks to his role in the Western comedy spoof A Million Ways to Die in the West.
Inside, we were dreaming about river getaways in 2014, when our theme for Best of the West was Waterways of the West. That meant exploring the travel and culture options around grand rivers such as the Colorado, the Snake, the Mississippi, the Salmon, the Yellowstone, and more. Bass Pro Shops founder Johnny Morris has created an oasis in the Ozarks, a stone's throw from where he grew up selling homemade bait in the back of his father's liquor store. And he'll be the first to admit that turning the property into a 4-star resort has been a labor of love for both him and his wife, Jeannie, whom Morris credits with finding the off-the-beaten-track location in the first place. The story begins in the 1920s, when a business entrepreneur and a railroad executive decided to buy 300 forested acres in the Ozark Mountains, south of Branson, Missouri. There, they built a couple of lavish vacation homes overlooking the Long Creek tributary of the White River. Over the years, the property changed hands several times before it was purchased in 1947 by a hotel operator who added a swimming pool, stable, and lodge, and marketed the place as Devil's Pool Ranch Resort. A decade later, the White River was dammed to form Table Rock Lake. But despite the added attraction of the new body of water, the property would again founder. Until one day in 1987, when Jeannie was perusing the for sale section of the Springfield News Leader, and a small listing for a 62-unit motel caught her eye. It was the beginning of a grand adventure that would culminate in the development of an 800-acre luxury vacation resort that includes 3 lodges, dozens of cabins, 5 pools, a golf course, a dinner yacht, and a sandy beach with an Airstream ice cream parlor, all set on one of the best bass fishing lakes in the country. Bring the family and settle in for a week of swimming, fishing, and stand-up paddleboard yoga, or head to nearby Branson for plenty of entertainment options. Either way, the gorgeously appointed accommodations, designed with input from Jeannie and her daughter Julia Manna, will make you want to do what June Carter Cash did when she got to Big Cedar Lodge. Move right in and stay a good long while. 2015, Buffalo Gap, Texas, Perini Ranch Steakhouse. On the cover, 2 years before a stroke took Bill Paxton from us at age 61, we featured the beloved actor in his film Texas Rising. Inside, the 5th edition of Best of the West made mouths water with a survey of the trailblazers of Western cuisine. Among the culinary notables profiled were celeb chef Dean Fearing, barbecue master Aaron Franklin, brewery maven Kim Jordan, and Navajo chef Freddie Bitsoa. Since 1983, Perini Ranch Steakhouse in Buffalo Gap, Texas, has been serving some of the best chuck wagon food in America. In 2014, after 3 decades of grilling up some of the best steaks in the country, it received a James Beard America's Classic Award. But owner Tom Perini hasn't let the accolade go to his Stetson-clad head. "We're a nice joint, but we're a joint," he says unapologetically. "It's rustic and on the ranch. Our whole deal with food is that I want it to be simple. We do things the old-time way because simple food can carry itself." In a world of elevating the dish, and this is my take on a classic, one-upping, Tom Perini is focused on keeping as true to the original recipe and technique as possible. His restaurant essentially serves as a classic Western food time capsule. "I want my food to look good, and I want you to recognize it," Perini says. "Lots of new chefs are making food, and you don't know whether to pick it up with your hands, or use a fork, or what it is. I've always said, if you find a leaf on our plate, you'd better send it back to the kitchen, because that's not supposed to be there.
2016. California Sierra Nevada, the John Muir Trail. On the cover. As the series run of AMC's Hell on Wheels drew to a close, we featured the bearded brooding star Anson Mount on the front of the May-June issue. Inside, this edition of Best of the West focused on 19 epic adventures of a lifetime. Readers were encouraged to raft the middle fork of the Salmon River, sail up and away at Albuquerque's International Hot Air Balloon Fiesta, ride the Black Hills of Dakota on a Harley, hit New Mexico's Green Chili Cheeseburger Trail, and more. Thousands of tired, nerve-shaken, over-civilized people are beginning to find out that going to the mountains is going home, John Muir wrote more than a century ago in Our National Parks. Is there any doubt which mountains inspired these words from the legendary conservationist and Sierra Club founder? The 211-mile John Muir Trail, a.k.a. the most dependably spectacular mountain route in the West, rambles along California's Sierra Nevada from Yosemite National Park to the summit of Mount Whitney. Rising over snow-dusted 13,000-foot passes, skirting beneath rows of gorgeous craggy peaks, crossing breezy meadows and forested river valleys through some of the country's most famous national parks and preserved wilderness areas, no trail better lives up to its name. If doing the whole JMT in 1 3- to 4-week ramble doesn't exactly jibe with your reality, consider an abridged version. Favorite sections of the trail, overlapping the 2,660-mile Pacific Crest Trail much of the way, include the northern portion from Yosemite's Tuolumne Meadows through the Ansel Adams Wilderness to Devil's Postpile National Monument and Mammoth Lakes. A long, more demanding trek at the southern end from Bishop Pass to Mount Whitney features the magnificent Ray Lakes area, beautiful Palisade Peak, and a summit shot at the highest point in the lower 48. Deadwood, South Dakota. On the cover, we visited with Canadian actor Adam Beach about his career so far and about his advocacy for more Native and First Nations representation on the big screen. Inside, we traveled to the tried-and-true iconic Western towns for our 7th Best of the West edition. The feature offered quick primers on visiting Fort Worth, Texas, Dodge City, Kansas, Durango, Colorado, Tombstone, Arizona, and several more historic destinations. What's in a name beyond a former hit HBO series title and a hint of irony? In the case of Deadwood, South Dakota, a town that has cheated death repeatedly over the last 141 years, only the most instantly recognizable sounding dot on the Old West grid north of Tombstone. From the name alone, you know Deadwood has been there, done that, and seen some things that would make Timothy Oliphant blush. Coined after a gulch full of dead trees where the first wave of 1870s Black Hills miners would encamp during one of the country's largest great gold rushes, laying to waste a Lakota land treaty in the process, Deadwood would swiftly gain a reputation as one of the roughest, rowdiest, and most remunerative mineral boomtowns in frontier territory, and fodder for some of the biggest names in Western lore. Wild Bill Hickok, Calamity Jane, Charlie Utter, they were all here, not always for a long time or a particularly good time, A few weeks after his arrival on the Utter wagon train in 1876, Hickok would be unceremoniously gunned down with a shot to the back of the head at the poker table by gambling sore loser Jack McCall, while holding, as the story goes, two pairs, aces and eights, known as the dead man's hand forevermore. Deadwood, of course, would live on through mining closures, prohibition, floods, several devastating fires, and civic debates about introducing legalized limited stakes gaming in 1989, to a small community now very well fed with casino tax revenues. Today, the entire town is a National Historic Landmark, drawing loads of summer guests to its brick-paved streets, quaint Victorian B&Bs, slot-machined hotels, $1-a-ride trolleys, hauntingly beautiful Black Hills back roads, and period-esque gunfight reenactments that you can time your watch to. Deadwood is one big piece of history wherever you look, says Amanda Kelly, Deadwood Chamber of Commerce marketing director, who offers some advice for beating the summer crowds. We're a year-round destination. People don't always know that. But it's really gorgeous here in the fall and winter, too. 2018, Colorado Springs, Colorado, the Broadmoor. On the cover, the striking portrait that covers our May-June 18 edition is that of Brady Jandreau, a real-life Lakota cowboy and first-time actor, whose struggles in rodeo inspired the critically acclaimed indie drama, The Rider. Inside, the 2018 Best of the West was made up of both mild and wild experiences. Among the mild were train rides, luxury lodges, spas, and golf courses. The wilder options included dog sledding in Alaska, snowmobiling in Lake Tahoe, sand railing in Oregon, and paragliding in California. When the Broadmoor opened in 1918, it was one of the premier resorts of its day, offering Turkish baths, steam rooms, massages, and oil rubs for 50 cents to $1.50. Today, the property is every bit as luxurious and as modern as it is historic. An entrepreneur, venture capitalist, and philanthropist, Broadmoor founder Spencer Penrose and wife Julie had traveled around the world with the idea of going back to Colorado Springs, then considered the uncivilized West, and creating an oasis of culture. Inspired by the exclusive spas in Italy, the couple spared no expense when they took over what was once a dairy farm in Colorado Springs at the base of Cheyenne Mountain to begin the project. The grounds were designed by the same landscape firm that created Central Park. The Italian Renaissance buildings, 11 in all, situated around Cheyenne, were designed by the same architects behind Grand Central Station. The technically difficult golf course was legendary. Today there are three, and one has been the site of the U.S. Senior Open. The Broadmoor now has 10 restaurants, activities ranging from horseback riding to ballroom dancing, and three additional wilderness properties on its 5,000 acres. One is for fly fishing, another is a ranch, and there's even a romantic lodge on top of Cheyenne Mountain called Cloud Camp, a hideaway Penrose would repair to with his drinking buddies during Prohibition. It all adds up to flawless Rocky Mountain relaxation. The second site offered in the 2018 edition was McCurtain County, Oklahoma, Beaver's Bend, Broken Bow. Oklahoma is full of scenic surprises. Spend some time in Beaver's Bend / Broken Bow area in McCurtain County, and you'll see what we mean. The southeast corner of the state, known as Choctaw Country, was the Choctaws' final destination on the Trail of Tears.
Today, it's a vacation destination for outdoor enthusiasts exploring the Kiamichi Mountains, a subrange of the Washitas, the Mountain Fork River, which contains the bend of Beaver's Bend, a meander that makes an almost 180-degree turn, Broken Bow Lake, and a couple of state parks chock full of natural wonders and miles of shoreline. But it's not all mountain streams, lakes, rivers, forests, hiking, mountain biking, fishing, hunting, kayaking, canoeing, paddleboarding, swimming, and horseback riding. There's also plain old porch sitting at waterfront cabins, and winery and brewery hopping at places like Fishtails Winery and Vineyard, Voihai's Winery, Girls Gone Wine, Beaver's Bend Brewery, and Mountain Fork Brewery. And of course, there's the replenishing of calories after a day of expending them outdoors. In the town of Broken Bow, high marks go to Papa Poblano's Mexican Cafe, homemade tortillas, Hochatown Saloon, cowboy burger and fries, Smith's Good Eats, homemade desserts, the Reel 'em In Cafe, catfish and barbecue, and 12 miles away in Idabel, the Red Bee Restaurant, chicken fried steak sandwich. 2019, Bozeman, Montana. On the cover, excited for the long-awaited Deadwood movie to hit HBO last year, we celebrated the Western Game Changer by putting its two stars, Timothy Oliphant and Ian McShane, on the cover in character. Inside, the 9th edition of Best of the West paid tribute to people we dubbed fascinating figures, innovators, influencers, and interesting individuals of the modern West. Among those featured were champion bull rider Keyshawn Whitehorse, horsewoman Riata Brannaman, Olympic archer Brady Ellison, Native Arthur Tommy Orange, and chef Eduardo Jordan. If there was one catalyst to the Bozeman boom, it was the release of Robert Redford's 1992 coming-of-age drama, A River Runs Through It. When that opened, it had an impact on tourism, BZN International Film Festival Communication Coordinator Cynthia Logan remembers. The film was shot in Livingston, Bozeman, and Big Timber, and its memorable fly fishing scenes were filmed in Gallatin Canyon on the Gallatin River, south of the city. Even the few critics who didn't like it gave 4 stars to the breathtaking scenery, captured by Oscar-winning cinematographer Philippe Rousselot. Suddenly, fly fishermen were filling up the Murray Hotel, where Buffalo Bill and Calamity Jane once stayed, and business picked up at the Angler Accessory Haven, Montana Troutfitters. The natural wonders that surround the town remain irresistible. Bozeman is 90 miles from Yellowstone National Park, 50 miles from the famous Chico Hot Springs, and just 10 miles north of Hyalite Canyon, famous for its pristine waterfalls and robust wildlife. Bookends. Comparing John Wayne's first and last westerns. In The Big Trail, we got the first glimpse of a future icon. The Shootist found him teeming with wisdom and experience. By Anson Mount. The Big Trail, 1930. Hiya, Zeke. That's his first line. And with its delivery, one can see that he's got it. It is the word we sometimes use when attempting to describe that indefinable quality of great leading men. For this young man, it is a simple charm that emerges from the lack of any need to charm. It is the ability to truly engage with the performers around him rather than to indicate a vague idea of engagement. And through that young man's clear-eyed understanding of a job done honestly, we find ourselves witnessing the birth of an American identity that bleeds across our screen like celluloid caught aflame. It was 1930 when a 22-year-old Marion Mitchell Morrison was stolen off the property's crew of a John Ford film and screen-tested for a Raoul Walsh product. Subsequently, he would be renamed John Wayne by the Fox Film Corporation's publicity arm and handed $75 a week to take on the leading role in one of the riskier investments in Hollywood history. It is often reported that The Big Trail represents one of Hollywood's earliest attempts to convert the movie experience into a widescreen format, ultimately flopping because the financial constraints of the Great Depression had left movie houses unable to convert to the new technology. While the first part is true, the second record is a bit more complex. There are, in fact, two English-language versions of this wagon train epic. A plethora of foreign-language versions were also shot in subsequent takes with different actors. Studio founder William Fox was known to occasionally take a risk, but he was not a blind gambler. Likely fearing the economic unrest of the time, Fox had Walsh shoot his film both in the traditional 35mm format and in the newer 70mm. Most scenes were filmed by two crews simultaneously, while others had to be repeated with more mise-en-scene for the expansive 70mm grandeur frame. With almost 200 wagons, hundreds of oxen, cattle, horses, and extras, The Big Trail was early cinema verite in its depiction of a westward trek into untamed wilderness, made by a dogged crew slogging across locations that spanned 7 states. While Fox successfully hedged his bets, only 2 theaters in the nation were capable of screening the widescreen version when it was finally released. He found himself trying to market a film for which the predominant inspiration had been a new technology with a broad vista, a theatrical promise that was not possible to fulfill. The movie bombed spectacularly. As was so often the case in Tinseltown, the sins of the father were visited upon the son, and Wayne found himself banished to the lesser sets of B-Westerns for a protracted sentence. It would not be until 1939, when his old mentor and friend John Ford had generated enough power within his own productions, that Wayne would be given another big shot, this time as the iconic Ringo Kid in Stagecoach. This second entrance is brilliantly portrayed in the foreword of Scott Eyman's carefully researched John Wayne, The Life and Legend. But The Big Trail remains a revelation, clairvoyant in its discovery of the genre's greatest leading man, and in its vision of what the film event would eventually become. Just take it from me. Make sure you watch the 70mm version. There really is no comparison. The Shootist, 1976. It's a bit like that jolt you get when confronted with a photograph of your father in his younger years. Now take that dog-eared sepia of a young man squinting into the sunlight with his whole life ahead of him and place it next to the color Polaroid taken at his retirement party, that of a thicker man whose smile, while maybe not as broad, is supported by the assuredness of a life well spent. This is something akin to the experience of watching John Wayne's first and last westerns back-to-back. Of course, The Shootist is not often regarded as one of Wayne's best. A multitude of actors play into this unfortunate accent for America's leading man, the chief of them being the war of backstage egos that might have shamed even the greatest production of Julius Caesar, the principal senators here being Wayne and director Doug Siegel.
Apparently, Siegel had never learned that the last person you want to tangle with on a set is an actor with power. The script itself is a rather flat adaptation of the novel by Glendon Swathout, an entirely passable but ultimately uninspiring Western that was soured from too many fingers in the soup. Apparently, the screenwriters had never learned that the last person you want to collaborate with on a story is an actor with power. But according to Iman, things were likely exacerbated by Wayne's health, which was not at its best. It has been reported and rumored that Wayne's portrayal of J.B. Books, a legendary gunslinger dying of cancer, was strangely poetic, given that Wayne himself was battling cancer at the time. Others treat this claim as apocryphal, as Wayne had battled lung cancer for a decade prior and lived. Again, the truth is always more complex. While it is true that Wayne had a cancerous lung successfully removed in 1965, more than a decade later, he would develop another malignancy, this one in his stomach, which would eventually take his life. By the time he was cast in The Shootist, the first cancer had gone into remission, but the parallels to a dying legend would not have been lost on any man who had stared down the Reaper and could still see him out there waiting in the plains. Perhaps it was the knowledge of just such an inevitability that led to the Duke's final performance being a perfect study of calm acceptance. A lesser actor, or a less experienced man, might have botched the role by layering it with angst and desperation. Instead, we are gifted with an almost whimsical acceptance of hard truths, and a sweet farewell to the world he now realizes he never knew, a world in which humanity springs eternal, like a tree splitting limestone. Marion Mitchell Morrison, also known to the world as John Wayne, was laid to rest on June 15, 1979, at sunrise. Above him was set a tombstone that would remain unmarked for 20 years. When it was finally given an epitaph, it would be in Duke's own words. "Tomorrow is the most important thing in life. Come to us at midnight very clean. It's perfect when it arrives and puts itself in our hands. It hopes we've learned something from yesterday." Philosophical, yet optimistic, it is a decent epitaph, though its purpose remains vague. It is perhaps the kind of phrase one might use as a kind of forked twig when trying to divine the extremely complex life and personality that was John Wayne. But this choice of epitaph is also ironic, and to me a bit sad, in that it was done in direct contradiction to a clearly stated wish that his future epitaph be nothing more than the following Mexican phrase: "Feo, fuerte y formal." Translated, it would have read, "John Wayne, ugly, strong, and dignified."
Hello, this is Michael. I'm reading articles from this week's San Angelo Standard-Times for the week of April 19th, 2020. Journalist Matthew McDaniel of the Standard-Times seems to write quite a few pieces about the history of San Angelo. Here's another article that he's written that was published today, April 23rd. "Stage lines played a vital role in linking Western outposts. With paper products, cleansers, and other commodities sold out in the pandemic panic, many Americans are getting their first look how delicate the supply chains that support modern life can be. The people living in West Texas in the 1860s faced similar challenges, because the few stage lines that ran through the state were often robbed by criminals or ransacked by indigenous tribes. Arguably, the most important route in Texas is from 1849 to 1881 was the Lower Emigrant Road, or Military Road, a vital trade and mail route between the Texas cities of San Antonio and El Paso. Between 1851 and 1854, A carrier business along that road was operated by Henry Skillman, a former military scout who received a mail contract from the U.S. Postmaster General to carry mail to Santa Fe. But when passenger service became part of the bargain, he was not able to afford construction and provisioning of the stage stands for the enterprise. According to historical information, Skillman's passengers from San Antonio to Santa Fe endured a 19-day journey in canvas-topped farm wagons for a fare of $25. But the Postal Service gave his contract to David Wasson in 1854 because he was failing to meet expectations. Skillman was still involved in the business, and when John Butterfield's contract to haul the mail was approved, Skillman was at the reins of the first westbound stage in 1858. Butterfield's routes extended from St. Louis, Missouri, and from Memphis, Tennessee, which converged and led out to San Francisco on the Pacific coast. According to historical information, the roads from the two eastern points met in Fort Smith, Arkansas, and led to Sherman, Texas, and points west, stopping at Fort Belknap and Fort Chadburn, before entering the Concho Valley near the present site of Carlsbad, heading west to join the California Trail, which came up from San Antonio via Fort Mason, crossing the South Concho near the present-day Cristoval. That service was discontinued at the outbreak of the U.S. Civil War after only 2.5 years. At the war's end, stage service returned to the area with the El Paso Mail Company, ferrying the post between San Antonio and El Paso. Before the town of Ben Ficklin was a thought, Major Benjamin Franklin Ficklin had been establishing stage lines, and he set up a stage stand near the present site of the ghost town with stone corrals to prevent thievery, a little house for the commissary, and picket houses for the men who worked the line. According to historical accounts, the stone walls of the corral were 8 feet high and divided into two equal sections with an open court in between. 3 trips a week. F.C. Francis Corbett Taylor, who is credited with organizing Tom Green County, managed the El Paso-San Antonio division of the line and made his headquarters about 1 mile south of what became the Ben Ficklin town site, where William Stephen Kelly was employed the first year he worked for the stage line. The commissary building was an adobe structure where the cook fed passengers on the stage for 50 cents a meal. The picket houses for the men were near the river. According to some accounts, behind the corral, Major Ficklin had built a 200-foot-long doghouse where he kept greyhounds. After Ficklin's untimely death from choking on a fishbone in March 1871, Henry Taylor and W.S. Kelly laid out a town site and named the settlement in Ficklin's honor. The company's original contract for carrying the mail called for 2 trips a week between Fort Concho and El Paso, and 3 trips to San Antonio. This was increased as the number of stage stands grew, and finally, the mail went through 6 times a week. The trip to El Paso required 4 days and nights of constant travel with time out for meals at stands while the drivers changed mule teams. 7 days and nights were necessary for the run between San Antonio and El Paso. According to historical accounts, the commissaries did not have butter or any perishable food for travelers, but the supply of buffalo and venison was plentiful. The fare from here to El Paso was $50 in gold, and from El Paso to San Antonio cost $75 in gold. The trip from San Antonio to Fort Concho, which took a little more than 48 hours, was made for $25. W.S. Kelly had worked for Taylor in Alabama, where Taylor was in charge of the route from Selma to Montgomery. So after the war, when Ficklin and a man named Sawyer took over the Texas mail routes, Taylor was transferred here, and he offered Kelly a job, which he accepted. The distance from Fort Concho to San Antonio was estimated at 220 miles, and from the fort to El Paso at 472 miles. At the stage stand, in addition to the corral and houses for employees, there were wagon shops, paint shops, wheelwright shops, harness shops, sheds for the coaches, and the commissary and mess. The stations between San Antonio and here were privately owned, but the company maintained the stops west of Fort Concho, and they distributed supply rations to the managers on the same basis as the Army did. According to published schedules, the stage left San Antonio at 8 o'clock in the morning and arrived here before noon the following day. The passengers laid over here until 1 p.m., when the mail was collected from Fort Concho, and then left for El Paso. Passengers could spend their time loitering around the station, hike up to the fort, or cross the river and visit Santa Angela. On the way west, the first stop was at Johnson Station, where the passengers received supper. They ate their breakfast at Centralia, reaching the Pecos River by nightfall, and came into Escondida before daylight. Here, the stage remained about 14 miles from Fort Stockton until they could enter without arousing the garrison too early. The first stage route led from Johnson Station to the head of the main Concho, but later Centralia was established where there was a watering station. Water was hauled 26 miles from the Concho and stored in a reservoir and barrels. The crossing on the Pecos was made over a pontoon bridge fashioned by the stage company by planking over a series of boats. The bridge was so narrow that the stage was taken over by human power, and the mule teams were led through the river. According to some accounts, some horse teams were used between here and San Antonio, but mules were used exclusively west of Fort Concho. Coming northwest from San Antonio toward Fort Concho, the stage made the first stop at Leon Springs, about 20 miles out. The route from there went to Boleyn, Comfort, and then Fredericksburg, where passengers could dine at the Nimitz Hotel. Loyal Valley was the next stop, the stage line continuing from there to the Llano River, which was crossed at Keller's Store. Across the Llano, the route led to Fort Mason, Rock Spring, and Peg Leg Station before arriving in Menardville. Split Gerbers, Fort McHavitt, Kickapoo Springs, Lippin Springs, and the station here lay between Menardville and Fort Concho. According to archived articles on the subject, the stage lines enjoyed brisk business and found many willing passengers who passed through this area before there were many actual settlers to speak of. Soldiers discharged from duty at all of these far-flung posts were given transportation, which the stage company redeemed at San Antonio. There were many prospectors and many officers traveling to and from fort to fort and used the overland stage. According to historical records, the stage coaches used on these lines were mostly Concord coaches made in New Hampshire by coach builder J. Stephen Abbott and wheelwright Lewis Downing, and they featured a special leather suspension system that turned the rough frontier roads into a gentle rocking motion that was better for the passengers and the horses. These carriages were the most popular of their day for stage service, and many were still being used in remote locations through the 1930s. The El Paso end of the line was dropped in 1882 as the Texas and Pacific was completed across the state, and a stage line from here to Abilene caught the train and made that connection to the west. As the country developed, more stage lines were started, and by the turn of the 20th century, stage lines operated between San Angelo and Ozona, San Angelo and Sonora, and to San Antonio as well. The line to Ozona went first to Knickerbocker and then Sherwood, with posts such as High, Dry, and Lonesome and Shoestring Stand in between. According to records, the average time for the trip to Ozona was about 12 hours, with the company traveling about 7 or 8 miles per hour. The fare was $5, or $9 for the round trip, and there were 41 gates along the route. Stage lines were also operated from here to Sterling City, Robert Lee, Fort McCavitt, and Paint Rock. The Sonora and San Angelo line was one of the last to be abandoned, last operated by Tom and Will Sable, requiring 11 hours in good weather at $4 per trip. During that bygone era, the stage bugle was loudly blown just before entering or leaving any town, or when approaching a stand, although almost all who can recall the sound have long since passed on. Ralph Watson was the first to put automobiles to work on the Ozona stage line using chain-drived Buicks starting in November 1908. Shorty Johnson was one of the first drivers. According to the archives, the change to automobiles on the Sonora route came in 1910 when Tom Savelle bought a yellow Cadillac, and by that time, the horse hacks on both routes had gone by the wayside. The first motor coach lines with a published schedule began to operate in this area around 1923. Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been... Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by Music and Memories at 1.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 71 and partly cloudy. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-50s. Then, tomorrow, sunny with a high in the low 90s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 12 noon.
It's time for the Noon Book Hour, an hour-long reading of books hand-selected by staff and read by volunteers at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Travels with Charlie in Search of America by John Steinbeck. Read for you by Gary Sinise.
From my earliest memory, if it was a cold day, Fargo was the coldest place on the continent. If heat was the subject, then at that time the papers listed Fargo as hotter than any place else, or wetter, or drier, or deeper in snow. That's my impression, anyway. But I know that a dozen or half a hundred towns will rise up in injured wrath to denounce me with claims and figures for having much more dreadful weather than Fargo. I apologize to them in advance. As a sop to hurt feelings, I must admit that when I passed through Moorhead, Minnesota, and rattled across the Red River into Fargo on the other side, it was a golden autumn day. The town as traffic-troubled, as neon-plastered, as cluttered and milling with activity as any other up-and-coming town of 46,000 souls. The countryside was no different from Minnesota over the river. I drove through the town as usual, seeing little but the truck ahead of me and the Thunderbird in my rearview mirror. It's bad to have one's myth shaken up like that. Would Samarkand or Cathay or Cipango have suffered the same fate if visited? As soon as I had cleared the outskirts, the broken metal and glass outer ring, and moved through Mapleton, I found a pleasant place to stop on the Maple. It's bad to have one's myth shaken up like that. Would Samarkand or Cathay or Cipango have suffered the same fate if visited? As soon as I had cleared the outskirts, the broken metal and glass outer ring, and moved through Mapleton, I found a pleasant place to stop on the Maple River not far from Alice. What a wonderful name for a town, Alice. It had 162 inhabitants in 1950 and 124 at the last census. And so much for the population explosion at Alice. Anyway, on the Maple River, I drew into a little copse of sycamores, I think, that overhung the stream, and paused to lick my mythological wounds. And I found with joy that the fact of Fargo had in no way disturbed my mind's picture of it. I could still think of Fargo as I always had. Blizzard-riven, heat-blasted, dust-rattled. I am happy to report that in the war between reality and romance, reality is not the stronger. Although it was only mid-morning, I cooked a sumptuous dinner for myself, but I don't remember what it was. And Charlie, who still had vestiges of his Chicago grooming, waded in the water and became his old dirty self again. After the comfort and the company of Chicago, I had to learn to be alone.